We stand here in great need. That's true every week, and certainly this has been a prolonged period of an awareness of our great needs. And so, you know, as I prepare every week and step up, you know, what am I going to say when I step into the pulpit? And how do I encourage our folks? And you know, my habit of just going verse by verse through the text, I'm going to preach what is there, but it is so applicable to our time period that we're in now. If you would, turn in your Bibles to Mark chapter 6. That's where I left off a couple of weeks ago. We're about halfway through the chapter of 6. But you're going to see some things over the next couple of weeks that we're going to pick up on and how God is doing stuff in our midst, even through the text from a thousand years ago. But as we stand in great need, I wrote down a few things. We are in need of a cure for COVID. This disruption in our lives has been far more prolonged than we anticipated, and we don't know if we're just in the midst of it or in the middle of it, because we don't know when the middle of this is. This could be going on for much more time. I have heard from many churches across the United States that have already planned not to meet in person until 2021 at the earliest. We're in need of racial reconciliation. That's been a highlight. That's always been true, but boy, it's been highlighted over the last couple of months. To be made aware and to do some things in the midst of this time. We are certainly in need, as we stand greatly in need, of love, of respect, of unity with one another, both in the church, but also as a humanity across the nation and across the world. We're in need of healing in marriages. COVID has taken a hard hit on families, marriages, children. We're in need of wayward children to return home. We're in need of economic recovery as people are holding on to their last bit of savings to go on. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not fully employed yet. The furlough has taken longer, and we're running out of funds, and the government promises much but delivers very little, and what are we going to do during this time? We're in need of hope. We're in need of healing. And not just physical healing. There's an emotional, spiritual weight that has been upon our folks, and we need some release, some relief. Quite frankly, we just need Jesus. Jesus is our only hope. He is the only healing that we can have in this world. And now is the time for the church, as I've said often, to step up and proclaim that. Everybody is barking out all kinds of things in our culture, but boy, where is the hope in Christ that is prevalent in our communication? As we take the next couple of weeks looking at the end of Mark, I didn't want to rush through the end of here. So today we're going to be looking very specifically at verse 30 through 44, seeing that Jesus is our provider. When you are hungry, Jesus gives provision that satisfies. This is an incredible chapter, and the risk here is that we'll get into this section and you'll see, oh, well, I know this story. I remember this from Bible school when I was a small child, or we've gone through this many times. And I don't want us to just look at this First Baptist Church fellowship meal that they're about to have in this text. I want us to really see how this applies in our day, that God is the miraculous, powerful provider in our lives today. I'm not going to promise you that we're going to break bread and everybody's going to be fed today. But I guarantee you that when you trust in God and you look with the eyes of faith, you'll see far more of what God is doing, that He has multiplied, that He will not be lacking in what you need, and He will provide it if you'll just open your eyes and receive it. So you look at verse 30. It says, the apostles... Which is interesting, they don't use this term very often early in the text here. The apostles, they're already designated, not as just the disciples that had been sent out earlier in chapter 6, but now Mark just kind of throws in this word here that will become far more prevalent later in timeline, but he's already recognizing the apostles, those set apart by God to be sent out for the proclamation of the gospel. The apostles returned to Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. Now, just to remind you, in chapter 6, and certainly if you have your Bible open or you have it turned on, you could scroll through and see that we, as we walk through this, Jesus sends them out earlier in the text, And then we had this little pause there, a reminder of what took place with John the Baptist and the beheading that had taken place prior to these days. But that we just paused and looked at what took place there, the sacrifice that is necessary at times to stand up for your faith. So as these disciples, becoming apostles sent out by God, have gone out and done some incredible things, then we learn about John the Baptist who sacrificed it all, which every one of the disciples would do so. And now we're coming back, and they're coming back to tell what took place. This is their first time to go on a mission trip, if you will, sent by twos. Go out, and you're going to be preaching the good news. You're going to be having power to heal some people, and they're going to come back. And what do you think those young men came back looking like? They had some success. There were people listening to them. You remember that these are just average guys, fishermen and tax collectors. They did not pass Hebrew school. They didn't progress and get to the advanced degrees. They didn't learn it all from all the rabbis. They basically had been called out by God, taught and instilled in them the truths that Jesus was giving them. They had seen some things Jesus did. Now Jesus sends them out. And you know what? This stuff works. When we trust in God and just do as He does, God does some miraculous things. So they come back with smiles on their faces, and they are just rejoicing and celebrating. Even me, a fisherman who probably stutters along the way, had an impact on some people. I want you to step into the sandals of these disciples for a moment, because sometimes we think God would never use us, but if we will just trust and go in His strength, following His lead, it'll be amazing to see what God can do in you and through you. So they come back here, and they're rejoicing. But I want you to look at verse 31. And He said to them, come away by yourself to a desolate place, and what does it say in your text? You're going to rest. They came back rejoicing. They were full of energy. They were just hyped up. They were talking great things. Oh, man. But overextension will exhaust them. And Jesus knows this full well, as He often made a habit of drawing away after great ministry opportunities. He went back because their power on the mission field was from God, so they need to come back and refuel. As we were on vacation, I couldn't get to where we needed to go on one tank of gas. We had to pull in. I know everybody wanted to go to the restroom, but I only stopped for gas. So go to the rest room while we're stopped at the gas filling station. They needed to rest because emotionally and physically they were exhilarated, but they were going to run out of steam. Here's the first thing I see in this text that what Jesus provides. He is a provider, and I love to connect this section of the text with what's happening with the meal that He's going to provide. He is a provider of our rest. He really desires for us to slow down and take in, because we can only run on the strength that He gives us. Some of us go way beyond the time period that is allotted for us. I heard a pastor say one time, a guy said to him, he says, you know what? You ought to work 7 days a week. You're just taking off. We never know where you are on Saturdays and all these other things. You need to be in the office 7 days a week. You know, the devil never takes a day off. And the pastor's response to him is, well, maybe that's why you and the devil are so much alike. The devil may never take a day off, but God says, you work in My power, and then you better rest and refuel in Me. And they're learning this early in their ministry. They've gone off and done incredible things. Now it's time to rest. Maybe some of you just need to hear that today. I don't encourage you to go to sleep right now, but you can do that this afternoon. Rejoice in ministry, but you also need to rest from ministry. Have a time of cessation from the running that you've been doing. Look at the rest of the text in verse 31 going into verse 32. For many were coming and going. I mean, there'll always be ministry and work to do. Many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. And verse 32 says in my text, and they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. Wasn't it Jesus who told us to come to Me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest? He is the provider of that rest. Which, by the way, rest really means you need to unplug. If you take a lot of stuff into your rest time, your cell phone, a laptop, your bank accounts to look over and pay your taxes if you didn't get it done this last week, You know, if you go into a rest time and you bring all the junk that you already have in your normal life, you're not resting. You're just bringing anxiety into a rest time. You need to truly unplug and connect with God. Bring your Bible. Go outside and just rest. You know, effective ministry and living in our lives includes four things. So I considered these two things that were included here, but I'm going to add four things to the list. First off, effective ministry, which these men were learning, takes consecration. Consecration is a surrendering, giving ourselves to God first. That's why I love that our worship is the first day of the week. We don't launch into the activities of the week without first consecrating ourselves, drawing away, connecting with God, and being filled by Him, because He is the fuel that we need to accomplish what we have in front of us. So there's a consecration that starts off for effective ministry. The second thing that we have to have for effective ministry is concentration. There's a focus, giving our attention fully to what we're called to do. We fill up with God, then we get a focus for God, and we don't get distracted to the right or to the left of what we have to do. We focus right on it and give our full attention. Then we go into the last two, which were stated in this text. There is celebration, rejoicing. You know, when you focused on something, you're seeing some success. It is right, and I struggle with this. I think there's always more work to do, but God has convicted me on occasion that says, you know what, you don't ever stop to just thank me and celebrate what has happened. Sometimes I have to pause and go, man, I haven't got as much done this last week, or I haven't got as much done in this last month, and I still see this long list. But God has convicted me and says, you ought to look back and see what I've done through you over the last week or over the last month. If you would start documenting some of these things, you will have a long list of things to celebrate. Sometimes we always have this rules or this judgment for ourselves, and sometimes we have it for others, and I've been guilty of this as well. I would like, you know, perhaps one of my children to be at this level. And though they make progress, I still see the lack and not the full that they've accomplished. I get convicted about that. I go, why can't I celebrate the small things and then continue to encourage the greater things? How many of you remember when your children were learning to walk? Those are fun days. And you're so excited when they stand up and they take their first step. But I guarantee nobody said when they fell down, go, well, what are you doing? You could have went across the whole floor. You got two legs just like I do. You didn't get in and see their lack. You saw their progress. Celebration is a part of effective ministry. Don't look at what hasn't yet been done, but thank God for what He has accomplished in and through you to this level. Give your praise to God. And the last is cessation, the resting. Giving your trust, knowing that He is in control. Yes, the long list to be done is still there, but pausing to realize you can't run a marathon if you're sprinting the entire way, you will burn out. Several years ago when we were at Christ Church and we held a 5K for our church to raise money to send some people to Honduras. And I was a runner in high school. I was very athletic. I hadn't really participated in a while. Some of my family had been practicing for this thing, but I gave zero practice to it. And so, it had been 20 years since I probably ran to anywhere farther than the mailbox. And so we got into this race, and you know what I did? Because I was up in the front. Michael Robinson was there, and he was a runner, if you remember him. So we got, and they launched the thing, and I sprinted off. I was in the lead for probably a quarter of a mile. And then I just burned out. I thought, my lung capacity isn't as large as it was in high school. I didn't realize that you lose something along the way. No, I should have paced myself. I should have prepared. There is a rest of trusting that He is in control and preparing for what He's doing. I wonder this morning if some of you are carrying the weight, a large weight of your family, carrying a large weight of maybe your business and in your job situation. You don't know what to do. You feel like you're carrying the weight of the world right now, and God is calling you to rest in Him. You can't accomplish it all, and you certainly won't accomplish it all today. But if God has called you to it, He'll always provide enough for it. You just have to trust Him and take the steps that you've been given. That's why there's the light into my path and a light to my path, in a sense, we follow the word. He doesn't show you the whole thing. He just shows you a little bit. So just take the steps He showed you and rest in that progress. calls us to live for him, but he also calls us to rest in him. Here's the second thing I see in this text is Jesus is our provider. He provides rest, but he also provides compassion. And oh, how we need to learn from this, to receive his compassion and also live out the compassion that he gives us. Look at verse 33. Now many saw them, this crowd that was coming and going, many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot, and all the towns got there ahead of them. And when he went ashore, he saw a great crowd. So as they were going to a desolate place, going to the other side, if you will, and going to a desolate place, there are many people who saw them, the disciples and Jesus. Oh, they know about what they can do. Now that's not just about Jesus. The disciples have become effective in their ministry. So they want to run to them. So the people saw Jesus and the disciples, but the most impressive phrase to me here is in verse 34, when he, Jesus, went ashore, he saw them. One of the greatest things about Jesus is that, yes, we can look at our lives, even if we don't know God, we look at our lives and we say, we're inadequate, we don't have enough, the world's bigger than us, every time we get boastful, we fall, and we're just not knowing what to do. But we begin to look out, and we're looking for Jesus. And it's not an uncommon thing around the world that people look for a God that's greater than them. They may call it different things, but they're looking for something greater because I've come to my capacity, I have limits, and I don't know what to do anymore. And so therefore, I need to look beyond that to see, is there something greater in this universe than me? They're looking. The great thing about Jesus is, though, he is looking for you. He didn't say you have to come to him. He says, I'm already coming to you. And when this crowd was looking and seeing, Jesus saw them. He didn't ignore them. He didn't run like some celebrity going, oh, here's a crowd again. Here's the paparazzi. Here's these, you know, fans that went, oh, man, just get me away from all this. He's actually looking for those whose hearts desire through faith something greater. He saw them. This is the start of his compassion. Because you notice here, he saw them. That is a precedent before or precedes the next phrase. And he had compassion on them. You can't have compassion for someone until you see their need, until you see the state they're in. You might hear some things, but until you experience it. I think of the 80s when the popular song was written and all the celebrity singers were singing it, We Are the World, We Are the Children. When they did that, because there had been starvation in Africa for a long time, and you might have heard about it, but when they put that song together, they began to show you pictures and video of children that are starving. I mean, maybe a 15-year-old kid who's weighing about 27 pounds because he's absolutely thin as nothing, and he can't survive, and you see it, you're moved emotionally. And you want to connect. When you see things, more than just hear about it, it moves you to compassion. And Jesus saw the people because he's a provider of compassion. Now, let me define compassion for us. Because, let me go on a little bit here. What does he see, and why was he compelled to give compassion on them? It says here, because they were, and what does it say in your text? They were sheep without a shepherd. And sheep are not the most intelligent creatures on the planet. They wander. They get lost. Oh, how I prone to wander. Didn't we sing that just a few moments ago? I hope that made a personal application. Because we are like sheep. Without a guide, without a shepherd, we wander. And when we wander without a shepherd or a guide who will come rescue us, we'll continue in that pattern. And I'm so thankful for the parable that shows us that even if a shepherd has 100 sheep and one gets away, that shepherd first knows it, he sees it, and he fixes the situation by going after them. That's the great shepherd in our lives. A compassionate shepherd, as Jesus was, sees their sheep wandering, but there's no one leading them. They're independently trying to find where to go. They have no one to call them and for them to listen to the voice. But when they hear my voice, they'll follow me. When he when he sees these people, they were helpless, they were starving, they were lacking spiritual guidance and protection. They were exposed to the perils of sin and spiritual destruction. This word compassion is the same word, same Greek word, same English word, used with the Good Samaritan. In Luke chapter 10, when the Good Samaritan in the parable was going by and sees a man who has been beaten and robbed and just left, and, you know, he had been looked over by the religious people who had walked by so far, but this Good Samaritan looks at him. We know the story well. Why? Because he did something. Compassion is not feeling sorry for someone. Compassion is moved inwardly to do something about the situation, to help. Literally, the definition of compassion, to be inwardly moved, to be so inwardly moved that you are compelled to do something about the situation. And the Good Samaritan saw the need. He was moved to compassion. When Jesus saw these sheep without a shepherd, he is moved to compassion. Not just say, oh, how sad of a state they are in. I'll pray for them. No, he sees that they need, and he provides compassion. So what does he provide? Look at the text. And he began to teach them many things. They were sheep without a shepherd. They were wandering. And the first thing they needed was spiritual certainty that God is on his throne and they can have a relationship with him. They need to hear the gospel. Our greatest need is not physical. Our greatest need is spiritual. Every one of us will breathe our last one day. Even if we have remarkable health for 110 years, one day we'll breathe our last, and the spiritual will far outweigh the physical at that point. Jesus provides for our heart and our mind, and that's why he steps into teaching them. But he's not done. You notice in verse 35, and when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, these same people he's been teaching, this is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Desolate place means there's no Walmart even here. There's not a Quick Trip to run to and to at least get the little, you know, food that they put on the rolling racks. Send them away is their answer. There's not a Sam's Club or a Costco for us to go buy in bulk. We can't do anything, so send them away to go into the surrounding countrysides and villages and buy themselves something to eat. That doesn't sound compassionate at all. They're in need? Well, at least give them some wisdom enough to go get something. You're hungry? Well, go get something. You're thirsty? There's water 3 miles from here. You can go get it yourself. That was the answer of the disciples. And so the disciples are going to learn here much that compassion is not just be concerned that they have an issue, but you have a compassion to do something about it. And so what does it say in verse 37? And he answered them, you give them something to eat. Now that's a shocking statement. It's not uncommon that you would have heard this before, and you're like, you give them something to eat. And I guarantee, you know, well, I can't guarantee. I don't know how you'd respond. I know how I'd respond. I'd be going, was that a plural you or was that a you to me? I don't really have anything, you know. I might have a couple of bucks in my pocket, but there are many people. I mean, I could go buy a little, you know, a little sandwich, but I might be able to cut it out into 16 pieces, but that's certainly not going to cover the need. But see, Jesus doesn't want us to think with what we see. He wants us to think and pray through faith of what God can do. So Jesus is a provider of compassion, so he's teaching them compassion before he even does a miraculous of, you know, thing of feeding all the people. He's wanting to get to the disciples' heart. They're always thinking, push away. Jesus says, no, you get involved with the compassion that you do something about it. We have physical needs, and we know that Jesus provides for our health and for our body. So their response to them, to him was, and they said to him, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? Fascinating. They know they couldn't even do that. I wonder just for a moment, before we move on to the section where he feeds them, have you ever found yourself, especially in these days of kind of wandering aimlessly, not sure what to do? Kind of like a sheep, Not sure what the day is going to hold. And perhaps, you know, you turn on the television, you watch the news, or you read your news online, or you're saying, oh, goodness, what's going to, you know, are we going to have to do this now? Are we going to have to do this now? There's so many contradictory things in the news. What are we supposed to do? What am I supposed to do about my job? What am I supposed to do about my stocks? Do I hold back? Do I reinvest? What about my retirement? It's just a mess, and we're kind of sheep wandering. Uncertain. Unsure. It takes a toll on people emotionally, and long enough in emotions affects the physical health. Some people are far more active prior to COVID, and then when COVID hit, we're kind of hunkering down. Even if you're still going to work, you're hunkering down. You're not doing the physical things you ought to be doing. And I think of Paul. At the end of Paul's writings in 2 Timothy, that was the last book he wrote. He's in prison. He's near the end of his life. We went through 2 Timothy about a year ago or so. And there, I see that he still wants to take care of his body. He can't go out and run a marathon. He can't, you know, go work out at the gym or whatever, but he's there. And when he writes to young Timothy, he says, send a coat. I'm cold. I want to take care of my physical health. You know, I'm trying to do what I can with the limitations that I have. And sometimes in our wandering and we're not sure what's going to happen, we ought to start focusing on Christ and saying, God, what would you have me do to take care of my body? Perhaps that is to wear a mask. Perhaps that is get up and walk on a treadmill or walk your neighborhood and keep some social distancing. Perhaps that is not just sitting and watching Netflix and eating bonbons all day. They even sell those anymore? Bonbons? Don't give them to me because I will be tempted to eat the whole box in one sitting, all right? But perhaps there are some things that we have allowed to be neglectful of, our health specifically, because, well, times are different. What if we go another year like this? There'll be a lot more people in hospital for medical defects that have nothing to do with COVID. It just has to do with why we were not doing what we ought to be doing to take care of ourselves. Jesus calls us to live in his compassion and with his compassion. I want you to remember that no matter what, you are in his sights. He sees you. He knows where you're at. He knows where you're at spiritually, emotionally. He knows where you're at physically. And he is simply a prayer away to call upon him and ask him for the strength that you need. Here's the third and final observation, and we get to the bulk of the text that most people run to. But I want to take a little more time prior to that. And this is what I see in this. Jesus provides miracles. I mean, he provides our rest. He provides compassion, but he provides miracles. A miracle is an event that's not explainable by natural or scientific laws. God works within natural and scientific laws most often, but when he works outside of that because he is not limited, that's a miracle. With divine providence, God regularly works through the natural, and I'm thankful for that. He is the creator. But as he opens up opportunities to do something miraculous, we ought to acknowledge it. You know, there were 7 miracles of Jesus in the book of John that just quickly, he changed water into wine. That was outside of natural scientific law. And for Baptists, for 2,000 years, we've been turning wine into water, or at least grape juice. So that's been, I guess, helpful. Healing the royal official's son in Capernaum. He was healing the paralytic in Bethsaida. He was feeding the 5,000, which we see here in this text. Jesus walking on water was an incredible miracle. Healing the man blind from birth. He did this in John chapter 9. And in John chapter 11, he raised Lazarus from the dead. And certainly it would precede his own resurrection from death. These were miracles outside of the natural scientific laws that we live within. So in verse 37, once again, but he answered them, you give them something to eat. Which tells me about miracles. Miracles are often accompanied by our willingness to do what we can do. We live within the bounds of natural order. But when God does a miracle, it often happens when we're in motion doing what we can do. Verse 38, and he said to them, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And they had found out. They said, 5 and 2 fish. Well, that's sufficient, I suppose. Then he commanded them, in verse 39, to all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and fifties. That's a large crowd. Verse 41, and taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven, and he said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided the two fish among them all, and they all ate and were satisfied. If miracles are often accompanied by our willingness to do what we can do, miracles are also often accompanied by trusting Jesus to do what only he can do. When you look at a task that is far larger than you or far larger than the team that you're with, and you go, I don't think we can accomplish much. I mean, the educational needs in this community that Corners Outreach is trying to impact is far larger than that ministry. But that doesn't make them hesitate to say, well, at least get moving, do what we can do, and we'll trust God to do what only he can do. It's like when you step out and you go, oh, I don't know if we can save America because so many people are lost and they have so many different views. We probably can't do anything. And I'm thinking, no, let's do what God's called us to do and see him do the miracles that only he can do. Only God can truly change a heart anyway. But he has called us to proclaim the gospel, to love people, to show compassion, and then you'll be amazed at what God will do. Do what we can do, and then he will do what he can do. So verse 43 says, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and a fish. They obviously weren't at my house because nothing gets left. But this was so much. Verse 44, and those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. That doesn't include the women and children that were there. If miracles are often accompanied by our willingness to do what we can do, and then accompanied by trusting Jesus to do what only he can do, I think miracles are often also accompanied by recognizing that Jesus loves to turn the insignificant into the significant. The small things, the faith of a mustard seed, just a couple of loaves and a couple of fish. If we are just willing to believe that miracles can happen out of the smallness that we see as insignificant and see what God can do to maximize that, which tells me he can take an individual that seems so insignificant and do a miracle in their life and make them significant. How many of you could testify that one small prayer accomplished a huge impact in this world? A prayer for a child, God does a miraculous thing. A prayer for a marriage, and God restores and builds from that. One small prayer can make the biggest impact. Something so small and insignificant, God can do miraculous things. Do we trust him to give even our small, little, insignificant bread and fish, our small little step of faith, and trust to see what he would do with it? These days, there will be much scarcity because there's not going to be a lot of provision that the world's going to be able to provide. We're going to have to start focusing far more on the God who will take our little things and make it more than enough. God is our great provider. Do you believe in miracles? Or do your beliefs limit you? Sometimes people say, I believe in miracles, just not in my life. Our limiting beliefs will blind our eyes to see what God can and will do. Do you ever feel that who you are or what you do is pretty insignificant? I just want you to know that God is still a miraculous working God. He works through the natural and scientific laws that he has established. But it's amazing when we step out in faith, when he steps outside of those boundaries to do a marvelous, miraculous work. I'm praying that God would show us through faith some miracles coming. If we have a revival in this nation or around the world, it will be because of a miracle that he's doing in the hearts and lives of men and women. But it will start because the church is doing what we can do. We're going to sing a song in just a few moments called Take My Life. I'll invite the worship team to come up. Let's consider it as Chip selected that song, Take My Life. I thought that's really what understanding Jesus as provider is about. When we step out in faith and trust him, because his provision is given to a heart that's ready to receive. If we hold and we stiff arm God out and say, oh no, I've got all of this on my own, God will allow you to stay in that position often. If you think you're enough, then we'll wait till you're ready to receive. But I'm telling you what, I am in a position going, I know I'm not enough. I know I'm insignificant in all of the things of the world, very insignificant. I'm just one little dot on this planet. But when I step out in faith and I trust, God provides all that I need. He provides physical needs, certainly, and he has done it time and time again in my life. But he's also provided the spiritual needs, the emotional needs. When I am down, he is the one who lifts me up. When I am uncertain of my future, he's the one who gives me vision to what to do. When I'm at odds with an individual in a relationship, he is the one who mends that. When I just surrender my own soul to him and humble myself, he will provide. And I wonder this morning, if it's time for you to step back in faith and say, I just need to trust the God who is my provider and stop trying to carry the world on my shoulders, trying to fix it all. Let me just trust and rest in him.